Hello, and welcome to our podcast on the challenges and opportunities of ESG investing from our event, New Paradigms in Asset Management. I'm Anna Pavlova, Professor of Finance at LBS and Academic Director of the AQR Asset Management Institute. We have pitched our tent at the intersection of the four big themes that we believe are critical to understanding the current investment scene. These are, in turn, environmental, social, and governance issues, the debate on active versus passive investment, the future path of financial technology, and the risks that shake or could potentially shake the world. We are indeed fortunate that to address this last topic, we have with us Professor Robert Engel of New York University, 2003 winner of the Nobel Prize for Economics. He is at the head of a genuinely star-studded range of speakers, a collection of very different but equal talents, well-equipped to grapple with the major themes I mentioned earlier. How do these themes fit together? Indeed, do they fit together? What influence do they have on one another? As with previous events from London Business School and the AQR Asset Management Institute, today's summit will examine the theoretical underpinnings of these themes, while at the same time delivering practical suggestions for navigating this new investment landscape. The hinge joining these two concepts, those of thought and of action, is the brain power assembled here today, our very distinguished speakers. First, let's hear from Professor Engel on the genuinely epochal happenings of recent history.
Here are the events that we think are the days which were most influential over the last two decades. And the biggest one was March 9th in 2020, a little more than a year ago. And this is a COVID event. But before that, we had Brexit. Before that, we had 9/11. Then there was a precursor to the financial crisis in February of 2007, and so forth down this list. And one of the things you see by looking at this list is if you're a risk manager and you don't know whether you're preparing for COVID or Brexit or terrorism, you've got a big challenge. How do you deal with events that are all unpredictable but are so different in nature? And I think this is a notion that might be called compound risk and that faces all kinds of risk analyses. So sometimes if you're protected against one risk, you also have protection against another one, but sometimes you don't. And so the joint occurrences are important to recognize. So I'm actually going to focus primarily today on climate change risk. And this is a big topic. It's one of the most important risks over the long horizon. It might not be the most important risk in the short run, but we're all wondering how to deal with climate risk. So investors in particular are facing the dilemma, what does it mean to invest with respect to climate risk? And I have actually four answers to this question here. One of which is we ought to use information, all the information we have on risks and returns, and that should include climate data and emissions data and stuff like that. That seems like a no-brainer, but in fact, it's not so true that climate data is universally used at all in figuring out where risks and returns are likely to be greater or less than you expect. Secondly, you might invest with a view, this view that the climate change is underpriced, in which case you would want to invest in companies that are better prepared for climate change rather than ones which are not prepared for climate change. Some investors think investing with a view is a good idea. It could be this view is wrong, so then you don't do well.
We will return to Professor Engel later in this podcast. First, however, let's hear from a speaker on the linked subject of ESG investing from Professor Laura Starks of Macomb School of Business, University of Texas at Austin.
I would like to talk about ESG investing and provide some evidence on the opportunities and the challenges of ESG for investment purposes. The title of today's program is, as Anna just said, The New Paradigms in Asset Management. And if you think about ESG as a big umbrella, then most of today's topics actually are ESG topics. So, for example, climate risk, inequality, these are clearly E, S, and G topics, each of them. They have those aspects. But if you think about DeFi, it also can be viewed from an ESG lens because it also has environmental effects, it has social effects, and it has governance effects. One central question about ESG is whether ESG attributes primarily reflect a firm's value or values. And this has caused a lot of confusion about ESG because it does have different meanings to different people. And correspondingly, the question is, are ESG investors primarily interested in ESG considerations because of a belief that it has effects on the portfolio's financial value, or because ESG investing corresponds to their own values? One thing I'd like to point out is that ESG investing is not simply SRI investing. SRI investing, socially responsible or sustainable and responsible investing, has been around for many, many years and is really centered on negative screening and people's taste and preferences. On the other hand, environmental, social, and governance investing can be based on taste and preferences. It also usually includes considering return and risk, and it has a number of different approaches, which could be, you know, a positive tilt, a negative screening, looking for return opportunities, looking for risk mitigation. And so for some, ESG investing is simply return and risk without the taste and preferences. For many, it's combining the two. So if we think about the motivations for ESG investing and its implementation, as I said, there's the non-pecuniary aspect of it with taste and preferences. There are also financial reasons, as I talked about, that people might want to pursue ESG. And then given those, we need to consider the differences between the ESG products and the ESG integration into the investment process. So if you think about the taste and preferences, that has more to do with the ESG products. If you think about the financial reasons, that often has more to do with integrating ESG into the investment process. So a number of recent asset pricing theories have given us more insights into ESG investing. And these theories really are based on taste and preferences for the most part. They all introduce non-pecuniary utility into investment decisions.
Later, Professor Starks looks at investor attitudes to climate disclosures and ESG measurement difficulties.
So in a survey of large institutional investors worldwide, Emir Ilhan, Philip Kruger, Zach Sautner, and I found that we asked them how important they considered climate risk disclosure as compared to reporting on financial information. And what's striking to me is that 79% believe that climate risk disclosure is at least as important as financial disclosure. So there is demand from institutional investors worldwide to get this information. But when you think about what is the information we need, if we look at carbon emissions as a measure of climate, and they are the largest amount of the emissions, but which carbon emissions do we measure? Scope 1, scope 2, scope 3? Do we look at carbon intensity and normalize by sales? Or do we consider, well, wait a minute, it doesn't matter how large you are. It matters how much emissions are you putting out. But in most countries, the companies do not have to report their scope 1, scope 2, or scope 3 emissions. So there's a lot of information that we don't have. Some other issues about using carbon emissions to measure climate risk. How do we translate this into monetary values? What are the social welfare costs? Do we try to add those up, the cost of cleaning up? Do we try to consider the cost of reducing emissions, the opportunity cost of avoiding production, or the cost of using technology to reduce emissions? Do the measures truly capture a company's carbon emissions? Because companies can greenwash their carbon emissions disclosure, and there's insufficient data for scope 3, which in some ways can be the most impactful. And then why restrict emissions information to only carbon emissions? Shouldn't we understand all of the greenhouse gas emissions? Further, there's evidence that companies have incentives to, as I said, basically greenwash their emissions. There's evidence on U.S. firms that they change their production decisions. There's evidence that they shift production from highly regulated states to less regulated states. There's also evidence that firms are outsourcing their carbon emissions to overseas supply chain partners.
Professor Daru Nacimoglu of Massachusetts Institute of Technology is bracingly skeptical about the whole notion of social responsibility on the part of business, as we shall discover.
I'm going to talk about corporate responsibility in the age of automation, inequality, and climate change. If you look at newspapers or listen to people making pronouncements in public forums such as Davos, corporate responsibility is all the rage today. You'll see Facebook advertising its commitment to new internet regulations, Philip Morris talking about making smoking history, and many of the big oil companies announcing plans to reduce greenhouse emissions. Many view this as a rethink of the shareholder values revolution and perhaps the beginning of a new age of corporate responsibility. Well, in my opinion, I don't think so. I think we are in the midst of very severe challenges facing the world, both economic and social. And we need fundamental restructuring of our institutions. And I worry that current proposals for corporate responsibility are not much more than empowering already existing CEOs, and they're not really coming to grips with existing challenges. To make this case, I'm going to focus on two of those that I have worked on and I think are particularly important: inequality and climate change. Let me jump into it and talk about inequality first. And I'm going to focus on the US first, but talk about other countries briefly in passing. Well, I think this figure tells where the origins of the inequality problem or labor market problems in general are. On the left, what I'm showing is the evolution of wage bill in the US over the four decades following World War II. And what you see is that in real terms, wage bill, how much private sector was paying to workers, grew very steadily, both because employment kept growing, but even more importantly, wages per worker kept growing. And overall, we have about a 2.5 percentage points faster growth in real wage bill than population. But on the right, over the last 30 years, you see a slowdown in the wage bill and then a flattening out. The private sector is not paying much more today to workers than it used to do at the beginning of the 2000s. This has had various sweeping consequences. The fall in the labor share is one of those, but even more importantly, it is intimately linked to the huge increase in inequality in the US. So these two charts provide a summary of those inequality trends. They show the real weekly wages for 10 demographic groups, men, women, all the way from high school dropouts, all the way up to workers with postgraduate degrees. You see that in the 60s and early 70s, and the same is true in the 1950s, those 10 demographic groups had broadly shared prosperity. Their real wages were growing in tandem. But since the early 1980s, you see a very different pattern. Workers with postgraduate degrees are continuing to enjoy rapid wage growth, but even workers or men with just a college degree is experiencing stagnation, and workers with lower educations are experiencing quite significant declines in wages. This is a phenomenal increase in inequality, and it's not just an increase in inequality, it's some groups losing out quite significantly while the rest are continuing to flourish. This pattern has some US idiosyncratic aspects, such as the bottom of the wage distribution falling out, but the overall increase in inequality is not just a US phenomenon. If you look at most OECD countries, they were not as unequal as the United States in the labor market, but most of them experienced increases in inequality, and in some cases, including some of the Nordic countries and the UK, almost as large as the US. More telling is the form that this inequality and labor market changes have taken. And here again, comparing the US to several other countries, you see a very strong parallel that all of these labor market trends have been associated with middle class jobs disappearing. And here, the way I'm showing that is dividing employment in every country into bottom, middle, and top tercile of occupations in terms of quality or wage. And the middle includes blue-collar occupation, clerical functions, retail, sales, office work, operators, and so on. And these used to be the jobs that were the bedrock of middle class and upward mobility. And what you see is that in all of these countries, these jobs have been disappearing. Now, such a complex phenomenon, increasing inequality that's gone on in many countries, the middle class jobs disappearing, a slowdown in labor market growth, you know, these are bound to have many explanations, from globalization to changes in institutions. But my own work points out to the importance of automation. And in fact, you can think that automation is important already from the previous chart, because what distinguishes all of those middle class jobs is that those were exactly the ones that were at the crosshairs of automation. For office jobs based on specialized software such as databases or accounting software, and for operator and blue collar jobs based on dedicated machinery, numerical control, and over the last 25 years or so, industrial robotics. And in fact, if you look at the effects of technology, you really see this twist towards automation. And there, I would like to preface this by saying that if you want to think about technology, the way that most economists used to do is to think of technology as something, you know, increasing labor productivity. And of course, when it increases labor productivity, it's pretty natural that it's going to have an almost automatically positive effect on wages. But in fact, it is very important to distinguish different types of technologies. And it is critical that some technologies, such as automation, substitute machines or algorithms for jobs, tasks previously performed by labor, while other technologies enrich the possibilities for labor by creating new tasks or increasing worker productivity in some of the tasks they used to perform.
Sometime later, Professor Acemoglu raises the notion of ethical automation.
So if the sunnier interpretation of what technology does, that it creates broadly shared gains both for capital and labor, then you would expect that places that introduce more robots should also have better outcomes for workers. So this chart looks into this question across different local labor markets in the US, defined by 722 commuting zones. And what you see is a strikingly strong negative relationship between industrial robotics activity and employment. The same is true if you look at wages, and the same is true if you look at inequality. Inequality increases as well. The places led by the industrial heartland of the United States, places such as Detroit, Lansing, Cleveland, but not confined to them, there is nothing unethical about automation. Of course, automation has been going on since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution with the spinning and weaving machines. And automation, as I showed you, was fast in the four decades following World War II. And it was also fast, for example, with the mechanization of agriculture before World War II as well. But what we are doing is excessive automation. Technologies that we adopt and develop are choices. And because of the business models of tech companies, venture capital business model, and also government inducement, we have gone too much into automation, ignoring other technologies that would have improved productivity, and more importantly, would have had different distributional effects, different opportunities. So it is critical that we have to recognize the direction of technology is a choice. It's a choice that companies make, but it's a choice that society and governments have to have a say in it as well, which brings me to the issue of regulation of technology. So what we are seeing here, therefore, is the first point that I want to make in regards to the corporate responsibility. We have to recognize that technology choices, especially when they are at the stage of deciding the technology paradigms and broad approaches, have a variety of societal implications. And it's not clear that existing models of corporate responsibility, with firms interested in their shareholders, interested in their CEOs' aggrandizement or pay, and exactly trapped with a particular way of approaching a problem, for example, how to best use digital technologies, are necessarily making the right choices. So therefore, here we have to think about how society, including government policy, can push companies towards different uses of technology that will be more beneficial, not just automation, but what we see here, machines and humans working together. The same themes you can see in the area of climate change. We are just finishing COP26, so I don't need to tell people about the urgency of the climate challenge, but perhaps this figure is not as well understood as people should recognize. Today, solar, bioenergy, and wind are actually cost competitive with fossil fuels. If you remove fossil fuel subsidies, which are estimated by some to be in the range of about $5 trillion globally, in fact, they would be cheaper in most tasks, not in heavy fuels, but in most tasks than fossil fuels. But we are not making enough of a switch to renewables. That's one important point. But the second important point is actually how we got here. If you look at the cost of, for example, solar, even as recently as the late 2000s, solar was prohibitively expensive. We've had tremendous technological progress in renewables, wind and solar especially. And this was not thanks to large companies just for show corporate responsibility. It was rather because of a variety of new innovations, learning by doing by smaller producers with government policy. Subsidies were very important, and government regulation in Europe and at the state level in the United States. And also pressure from consumers was very important for generating some of this switch. But in fact, the story is even more interesting. And to show you that, let me plot what's happened to innovation in renewables. So I'm showing four measures of renewable or green technology patents relative to either fossil fuel patents or all patents. And in all cases, you see exactly the equivalent of where that cost declines in wind and solar were coming from. From beginning of 2000 to around 2010, you had a huge turnaround and increase in these patents. This was the era of renewable innovation. And again, this wasn't the large companies. But then what happens? After 2010, you see exactly a reversal. Where is this reversal coming from? Well, this is not a US phenomenon again. If you look at other countries, Canada, Germany, France, you see exactly the same pattern. And in fact, this reversal is a global trend, and it is caused by the energy sector, which led to a significant decline in gas prices. And together with gas prices, the gas share of fuels has increased, and this has dislocated renewables, and more importantly, it has reduced renewable innovation incentives. I'm showing again the green to fossil fuel patents in the US and what's going on with the natural gas price index. So exactly the same pattern in the two of them, and it's not too much of an imagination to say that the two are causally related. What's going on here is exactly that the energy sector, while touting its green credentials, has been investing so much in natural gas and shale gas that it has completely stopped the most promising part of the transition to green energy. And again, we see the same thing. Corporate responsibility, whatever CEOs say, is not to be believed. At the end of the day, CEOs are working either for their shareholders, sometimes just for their own aggrandizement, or sometimes for both. But I think this is no longer good enough. In the language that James Robinson and I introduced in our book, Why Nations Fail, we are going through a critical juncture. There are major threats to the existing order. There is a need for reform, and I think it's broadly recognized, but there is no clear path of exactly what that reform will go. There's a lot of agency, there's a lot of contingency, and we really need to find a new way. Throughout most of the history, the main barrier that you have to work against was the excessive powers of elites via coercion and control of key assets. Today, I think we are seeing related but quite distinct challenges creating this critical juncture. Again, I will confine myself to climate change and inequality. What we are seeing is labor market, which is where most of people have their opportunities, being destroyed by excessive automation, and this creating a two-tier society. And then we are also seeing the usual industrialization dynamics, which was often useful for increasing GDP, bringing huge amounts of environmental damages, especially with climate change. So both of those require new institutional frameworks, but together with those institutional frameworks, you really require different approaches and different incentives and different responsibilities for corporations. Institutions are no good unless you have buy-in from corporations, because at the end of the day, new technologies are going to be developed by corporations, they're going to be implemented by corporations, energy is going to be produced by them, labor is going to be hired by them. So what we need is really rebuild inclusive institutions, but differently from the past, where reducing coercion, creating equal opportunity, creating a level playing field, and enforcing basic property rights and security for most players was enough. Today, I think inclusive institutions will have to have a major element of regulation of technology. Now, that might at first seem quite dangerous, counterproductive, because after all, innovation is the lifeblood of modern market economies, and who is it that the government or bureaucrats should come and regulate technology? But both areas that I emphasize as critical highlight that regulation of technology is vital. If we don't regulate technology, existing corporate structures are going to go more and more into automation, creating this two-tiered society.
The active versus passive debate is central to any discussion of investment practice in our time. Is passive investment merely free riding on the decisions of active managers? Is active investment merely an expensive way of achieving below average results? And how do both fit into the rise of investing that takes account of ESG factors? I'm pleased to say we have two distinguished practitioners from either side of the debate to guide us today. Representing passive or index investing was Rick LaKyle, Executive Vice President at State Street. And appearing on the active side of the argument was Chris Ego, Head of Core Investments at AXA. First, over to Rick LaKyle.
Let me first start off with what we would say in any index context. And on my first slide, we asked the question, is active versus index management simply a zero sum or a slightly negative game? I didn't want to start off, particularly in this illustrious company, talking about the subject from a purely academic and theoretical perspective. But when Nobel laureate William Sharp talked about the arithmetic of active management, he was really making an empirical observation as well that after costs, the return on the average dollar will have to be less than the return on the average passively managed dollar. Now, there are a lot of caveats to do with the universe here. And I think we've tested this hypothesis in a sense live for a great many years with fund universes, mutual fund data, and so forth. And I think it has proven to be quite robust, but I didn't come with a whole stream of data, but really to outline again the principal issue, which is why indexing can be effective. And that's true in relation to a customized universe as well, including, for example, ESG-centric companies. But that's really the first line of argument that's not different from ones that you'd have heard before. And in fact, we've applied it in many different contexts, including fixed income, emerging market debt, and many areas where you think there should be a market inefficiency that makes it relatively straightforward for people to outperform. But I think, as we know, ESG has many more angles, and simply performing in line with the index, although it's actually a very effective way of delivering long-term returns, is not the only thing that we can do as asset managers. And I learned this over many years as an index investor and the last 12 years as global CIO at State Street Global Advisors. You see the good, the bad, and the ugly when you own an index fund. And that's why stewardship engagement is so important to all managers, but particularly those who don't have the option to change the portfolio. So if just to outline the whole vision for stewardship, the vision is potentially a little bit different for an index fund manager. Certainly the time horizon can be quite different. And the fact that you own all securities tends to mean that you focus on the more systemic issues rather than the idiosyncratic company level strategy issues. And I guess at the heart of that is the need for strong, independent, effective boards to ensure that companies are held accountable and are effective in their stewardship of the company, including ESG. So that combination of strong, effective, independent boards focusing on a sustainability strategy that we measure in a number of ways, including our own proprietary R factor, but in many other respects as well, gives us a degree of confidence that we're getting good results for our clients in the long term when they're investing in index funds that can include things that may be judged by many to have problems attached to them. But in fact, the very nature of this subject, where you may have a discount for those enterprises that have some challenges ahead of them, means that the catalyst can often be successful engagement to actually realize value. I guess it's another way of saying that the role of the index manager is to ensure that they're doing what they can to ensure that the market portfolio has strong returns as a result of attending to these systemic issues. The sorts of things that we do on the following page, driven by the Principles for Responsible Investment and the blueprint that they put together, and we'll look at some of the processes within stewardship and engagement. We need to be risk-based in the way that we prioritize. So look at themes that are very important, but also look at the portfolio you've got and where you can have the most impact in terms of either assets under management or the difference you can make where there's a serious problem. We've set goals for the number of companies that we're engaging with. We don't pretend that we're going to engage with every single company in the portfolio, 9,000 of them or thereabouts, but we focus on the ones that really matter. And we use both our voice and our vote. And I think this has made a difference where we've had a dedicated campaign like the one we had in Gender. We put the Fearless Girl on Wall Street. It's been very effective. We've set ourselves goals and we monitor the impact to make sure that we're continuing to hold ourselves accountable for that objective. So that's, I think, an effective combination of efficient portfolios plus engagement and stewardship can give very, very strong effect. I did point out one other attribute of indexing, which is that you can very easily fine-tune the portfolio and the exposures to particular issues that you're focused on. And I think if you do have the viewpoint that the market is not completely efficient in relation to ESG, it's relatively straightforward to design a portfolio that systematically and in the long term extracts those efficiencies by either constraining the universe or reweighting the portfolio in line with beliefs around ESG. ESG indexing is emerging as not just indexing plus stewardship, but a sort of customization that can focus on where we can make the most impact and have the best returns, particularly for those who've got a strongly held belief around market inefficiency in ESG. So that would be my pitch for why it's relevant and attractive to be indexed in relation to ESG.
And now over to Chris Eagle.
I think the last time Rick and I were on the same panel, we were talking about interest rates, inflation, and asset allocation, which is perhaps a sign of how things have changed in the investment world. I would pick up on the last point that Rick made regarding ESG indices, and this is where I think the line between traditional passive and traditional active becomes blurred, because any decision to set an investment strategy against an index is an active decision. And I think we shouldn't get too hung up really on the differences between the two approaches. We share many of the same tools and particularly around stewardship. But I'd just like to make a few points about active investment management in the field of ESG. I work for an active manager. And, you know, just to reiterate the standard argument that the approach of active investment is that it targets a better outcome for the investor than that provided by simply investing in a market index. And those outcomes can be targeted. They could include capital growth, lower volatility, fewer drawdowns, or more income than a passive indexed approach. In order to generate those outcomes, of course, active managers seek to create diversified portfolios through the selection of securities based on fundamental analysis, rather than merely sizing those allocations depending on the weights of the securities in the benchmark. And ESG brings an additional dimension to all of this. It's concerned with both risk management and identifying investment opportunities. A focus on ESG factors allows active managers to identify and quantify potential risks coming from a company's operating model and make judgments about the materiality of those risks. And analysis is fundamental to that process. Analysis would take into account how a business's operations impact on the physical environment under the E pillar, and that could include being at risk from climate change, and we heard some of that in the previous presentation. But we can also incorporate social factors, how the operating model interacts with human capital management or local communities or indeed customers. Governance is clearly important in that a lack of governance can lead to issues around the credibility of accounts, for example, or excessive executive pay, or even illegal activities, as we've seen in some cases in the past. So active managers that are pursuing ESG analysis are trying to identify, quantify, and judge the materiality of these risks the company may be running, and all of this seen through the dimension of ESG investing. And the bottom line is that it's better to be aware of these risks and to take the necessary portfolio action should they materialize and have a detrimental impact on a company's financial performance. ESG analysis also helps identify investment opportunities. Companies with better ESG profiles are likely to perform better over time. Perhaps the empirical evidence doesn't quite support my statement, but I certainly think looking forward, it's a belief that as active managers need to hold, in that companies that are able to display a better ESG profile are going to be better run companies who are minimizing their risks and exploiting their growth advantages. And that will result in better financial performance in the future. In very specific areas such as climate change, ESG allows active investors to identify climate leaders, those companies that have already have a lower CO2 output, transition leaders, meaning those ones that are leading the pathway to net zero, and the laggards, the ones that aren't quite with the program. And being an active investor allows us to make allocation decisions to those companies within portfolios. So we can allocate more favorably to the leaders and the enablers of technology related to climate change and exclude or at least seriously underweight the laggards. And I think you can make the argument a passive approach would result in a suboptimal allocation across those types of companies. ESG is becoming more central to many investment processes, and the approach requires additional inputs into security analysis, allowing active managers to target non-financial factors as well as financial factors in the investment outcome. And we've heard a lot already about databases of ESG factors. These are one of the tools in the toolkit for active managers today. They allow us to create ESG profiles at the individual security level. And I think the data is becoming better, more informative, and more reliable through time. And this analysis complements the fundamental financial or security behavior analysis in order to enhance the stock selection process. And active managers are thus looking to select securities based not only on their financial fundamentals, such as earnings growth and profitability, but also on their ESG profiles. And the combination, in our view, would result in a stronger risk-adjusted return and better ESG profile at the same time for a portfolio that's actively managed. Some of the tools, of course, we share between active and passive managers. I would argue, though, we have a broader set of tools to influence the behavior of companies in terms of their ESG profile. And not least of these is the ability to adjust allocations dynamically through time to optimize both financial and ESG outcomes. Now, I'm not saying that market timing is an effective way of managing portfolio over time, but the ability to reduce or increase exposures to certain companies based on incoming ESG data remains crucial to the success of an active management strategy. We're relying on this growing field of ESG data, disclosure and transparency is very important. So active managers welcome the development of initiatives like TCFD and SFDR, which is a regulatory attempt to minimize greenwashing in ESG strategies. And I think that supports the credibility of the active management approach because it provides some level of security to the end investor if there is a strong regulatory framework to regulate these strategies. Using ESG data supports active stock selection based on approaches like choosing the best in class, allowing more concentrated portfolios, and managing active risks such as active share in equity portfolios and tracking errors. These techniques clearly lead to a different weightings and risk profiles to a passive portfolio, and that provides end investors with a clear choice between the two different approaches. We've talked about voting and engagement. We share the approach that Rick outlined in terms of adhering to the PRI principles. Voting is an extremely useful tool, as we've seen on a few occasions in the very recent past. And at AXA IM, we are actively pursuing both engagement with company management and targeted voting, particularly on areas around things like climate share, biodiversity, and diversity and inclusion. There is also this focus on active managers having the ultimate tool of disinvestment. I think this needs to be used carefully. We take the approach that we want to engage with companies first, give them the opportunity to convince us that they're changing their business plans. It's very unlikely that individual investors are going to hold a sufficient number of shares or be a large enough creditor that their disinvestment will have a detrimental impact on a company's financial stability. But I think divestment is a powerful and fairly public tool that can be used at the last resort if companies continue to be laggards in terms of meeting their ESG targets.
We promise stimulating discussion of the role of technology in modern finance. And to that end, we came up with two speakers with deep knowledge and invaluable insights in this area. First, we welcome Hyun Song Shin from the Bank for International Settlements.
Just to set the stage, you know, we can think of money in the classical theory of money as a record-keeping device. It's a record of goods sold and services rendered in the past. And there is, in fact, a very famous paper by Narayana Kochhalkota that has an analysis of money as a giant ledger that records the complete history of all transactions, so we have a sense of who owes what to whom. Now, in that kind of approach, lugging around a huge ledger was more a theoretical construct. It was there partly to show how much more elegant money is as a convention, because you wouldn't need such a complete ledger to record who owes what to whom. But the irony, of course, is that the advances in cryptography and computing has actually made that kind of ledger feasible technically. And that's where we have blockchain technology. So what is the rationale for this kind of universal ledger? And what is the rationale behind blockchain? Well, the idea is that blockchain really brings governance benefits in the sense that it gives the kind of checks and balances that are going to promote the integrity of the system without having to rely on a central authority, a central trusted authority, you know, like the central bank, and without the need for intermediaries like commercial banks. And the idea is that we can update the ledger through consensus by giving incentives to the validators, the miners, to update the ledger in such a way that will stick to the unique true path of transactions. Now, it's a really ingenious idea, and the governance benefits are clearly very large. But the question is, what are the costs of going in this direction? And what are the trade-offs that are involved?
A little later, we hear of these trade-offs.
And the idea is that there are three possible objectives that we could envisage. One is the decentralization agenda, but the other objective is to have security to form that consensus in a secure way so that it's a robust and self-sustaining arrangement. But at the same time, there's a third objective, which is to be able to do this at scale so that we can take advantage of the technology for the underlying economic reasons. So for instance, if we wanted something which is decentralized and secure, you know, having one chain and doing everything on chain would be one way of doing that, but then you would not be able to secure the scalability.
Professor Campbell Harvey of Fuqua School of Business, Duke University, spoke of the development of decentralized finance, or DeFi, a global decentralized financial marketplace that can be used by anyone with a computer, and the opportunities and potential drawbacks involved.
So decentralized finance actually solves problems that exist today. So let's start with inefficiency. And I show this image of one of the very first Western Union wire transfers. And this is from 1873. And notice it's for $300. But I also want you to notice the fee that was associated with it. And that fee is $9 or 3%. 3% fee? That sound familiar? Today, when you swipe a credit card, 3% fee. So it is remarkable how little has changed in 150 years. And that 300 basis points or 3% is an enormous fee, especially for retailers that operate on razor-thin margins. But this is just an example of inefficiency. For example, the settlement of a stock transaction, so from the execution time for that stock to be in your name is 2 days. That just doesn't make any sense. We've all struggled with the slowness, the insecurity of wire transfers. So decentralized finance offers something completely different. Indeed, in decentralized finance, there's no difference between execution and settlement. It happens simultaneously. So limited access is the second problem. And many know that 1.7 billion people are unbanked in the world today. And that seems completely, you know, unacceptable. But there are many more, in my opinion, we don't have hard data on this, that are underbanked. And let me give you an example of what I mean by underbanked. An entrepreneur has got a very exciting idea that promises to return, let's say, 24% of return on investment. The entrepreneur needs funding. The entrepreneur's got a bank. They go to the bank and ask for a loan, and they're turned down, even though the banker says, oh, it's a really good idea. But to be honest, I'd rather deal with one larger customer than 100 customers like you. But given you're a customer of the bank and you've got a credit card, what we'll do is we'll increase the credit limit on that credit card so you can take the loan out. We know how that works, that the rate of interest on a credit card loan could be 24%. So what does that mean? It means the project isn't pursued. That's the sort of friction that decentralized finance addresses. So in decentralized finance, it doesn't matter if you're a big player or a small player. Everybody is just a peer. And for our economy in general, we need these projects that have the 24% rate of return. We've been stuck in 2% real GDP growth, Europe 1%, Japan 0. And in my opinion, substantially contributing to this lethargic growth are all of the financial frictions. I want these projects to be pursued. So when you cut out that middle layer, when you put people directly together, savings rates increase and the lending rates decrease. You don't need to pay for the brick and mortar.
Professor Harvey turned to some potential downsides.
But it's very important, if you're going to be involved in this space or to assess where the space is actually going, is to understand the different risks. So let me start with smart contract risk. So smart contracts are the algorithms that you interact with on, let's say, the Ethereum blockchain. And I argue that this is a new attack vector. And what do I mean by that? So think of a hacker that wants to break into, let's say, Target, which was done a few years ago. It's really hard to get in. So it's going to take a lot of effort to get in. And then once you're in, you're faced with millions of lines of code that you need to figure out. So with smart contracts, it's the opposite. Given it's open source, you're in, right? And everybody's in. So you've got thousands of potential exploiters looking very carefully at these contracts and trying to find some sort of vulnerability. So this is smart contract risk. And there are firms today that exist with the sole purpose of auditing a potential smart contract before it's actually posted on the Ethereum blockchain. So this is very important. And of course, there's like two types of errors, at least two types. One is a simple logic error, which could be devastating. And the other is more subtle, and I want to talk about a few examples. So the logic error, think of that as the contract has got a balance of, let's say, 13.9999 Ether. And a command in the contract is to pay out 14. So the command is rounding up the 13.999 to pay 14, but the contract doesn't have 14. And the command fails. Okay, so it's a simple logic error, and indeed, it's a common, unfortunately, logic error that insufficient balance means that the transaction will fail for sure. But economic exploits are much more subtle. And let me give an example of what I mean by this. So suppose that there's a contract that does some exchange, but it relies upon an external price feed. And this is the idea of an oracle. So an oracle gathers information outside of a particular blockchain. So suppose the oracle is pointing at a particular exchange, but that particular exchange is illiquid. So an exploiter could attack that exchange, the illiquid exchange, to manipulate the price. Then that price goes back to the main contract as the truth. And then the exploiter can actually profit from that price manipulation.
Let's end with a few words from Professor Engel.
What kind of a world will my grandchildren inherit? And they're kind of pessimistic about what we're going to leave for them, and that's a problem. So it's pretty important that we recognize what the issues are, what the risks are, and see if we can do something about it. And if we can, it's going to make them a lot happier.
Thank you for listening. To discover more insights from our distinguished speakers, videos of our presentations are available on the AQR Asset Management Institute website. Go to london.edu/AQR Institute. You'll also find the full session with Laura Starks there. We hope you have found this podcast informative and stimulating, and look forward to welcoming you at future events.